Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities that Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox scholars need for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. Today, we begin a brief series interviewing our first ever cohort of conference fellows. Following a competitive application process, recipients receive free registration, recognition on our website, and an invitation to speak about their scholarly work on this podcast. These fellows fall into two categories, Nisbet Fellows and Clergy Fellows. Nisbet Fellows are accepted conference panelists who are graduate students or non-tenured faculty, including adjuncts, at a college, university, or seminary, and they may be from any scholarly discipline. Applications for the 2026 cohort will open by about September of 2025, and we'll likely have some changes now that we've gone through our one round, so definitely sign up for our newsletter to be among the first to know when they're available and how it will look. The Nisbet Fellowship specifically is named after Robert Nisbet, who was a professor of sociology at Columbia University. He is the author of numerous books, but his seminal work, The Quest for Community, is especially relevant to the Ciceronian Society and its core themes. He particularly represents the interdisciplinarity that we value and the affection for tradition and place that characterizes our work. Today's Nisbet Fellow is Theodore Madrid. He is a PhD candidate studying politics at Hillsdale College's Graduate School of Statesmanship in Michigan and hails from Columbus, Ohio. He attended the Pontifical College Josephinum, I think I'm saying that right, where he earned his BA in Philosophy and Humanities. Madrid is currently writing a dissertation on religious liberty, examining the thought of John Carroll. But his research includes First Amendment jurisprudence, the relationship between religion and civil society, natural law theory, and contemporary education reform. Welcome to the show, Theodore.
Thanks, Josh. Good to be with you.
So let's start with this question. Given our love of place here, tell us about where you were born and raised.
Yeah. So I was born originally in California, where my parents were born and raised and where they started their family. And then about the time that I came along, they were thinking of uprooting and moving somewhere else that was more amenable to family life and what they were looking for in those regards in California. Mm-hmm. Even back then, was starting to change in a direction they didn't like. And so they looked various places and found some friends and community out in Ohio. So when I was about 6 months old, we packed up and drove from San Diego to Columbus, into a small town kind of outside of Columbus. And that's where I grew up. So a very kind of rural, very beautiful environment. Reminds me in many ways kind of the Shire, although Columbus is growing so much that maybe it's not that way anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I grew up in a very peaceful, small town near the big city, and then lived there for my entire childhood. Went to school at the Pontifical College in Columbus, worked in Columbus for a little while, and then came up to Hillsdale about 4 years ago.
Excellent. What small town are you talking about?
Called Hebron, Ohio.
Okay. I've heard of that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's near Granville, which is where Denison University is.
Okay.
Not a huge school, but yeah.
No, but very well thought of, as I recall, in Ohio, that particular school. And I've never heard of what is a pontifical college?
Yeah, so it's interesting. There are, I think, 18 maybe in the world, and all but one are in Italy. I think they're actually in Rome. So what they are seminaries that the Pope has a particular care for, and so gives a special designation and then a particular relationship with Rome, the Holy See, to oversee, to some degree, the operation and mission of the institution. So it's very unique that, who would have guessed that in Columbus, Ohio, of all places, would be one of these pontifical seminaries. But this goes back to a very interesting history with regard to its founding. Monsignor Joseph Jessing, who was the founder, was a actually decorated war hero in the Prussian military, came over to Ohio, started an orphanage for German orphans, which over time, because some of them intended to enter the seminary and become priests, grew into a seminary. And then, given the delicate nature of that work and the sort of mission aspect, he appealed to the Holy Father for some help. And then that led, in brief, to the designation as a pontifical seminary. So, you know, today, how direct that relationship is, maybe not as direct as it used to be, you know, a lot of local autonomy in the operation of the institution, but maintaining that relationship comes with certain distinctive characteristics.
That's so interesting. Like, of all the places, Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, I know.
I'm surprised there hasn't been, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if more show up in years to come. I don't know if they're still planting such pontifical colleges, but that'd be an interesting thing to happen.
Yeah, and there definitely are pontifical non-seminary colleges, a few in the U.S., I believe.
But oh, really? Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay. Well, that's, yeah, again, I had never heard of that. I will not hold it against you that you're from Columbus, at least for this particular interview. As we discussed beforehand, I am a fan of the Maize and Blue Michigan Wolverines, born and raised that way. It's part of my tradition, but I guess it's also part of my tradition to not care about Columbus, Ohio. No, I'm just kidding. It's a growing and fascinating city. A lot going on there. And I used to live in Ohio in the rural areas. And there are parts that look like the Shire. I remember visiting the Hocking Hills area with my family. Mm. And that's straight out of a fantasy land. It's just really cool looking. Mm-hmm. Well, so you're at Hillsdale and you're starting your dissertation, as I understand it. And that's a tough moment. I remember being in that position myself. Really wasn't that long ago, frankly. But it seems like an eternity ago at times. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what you're aiming to write on and why.
Yeah, so the topic of the dissertation is Archbishop John Carroll, who was the first Catholic bishop in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And a particular theme is his understanding of religious liberty. So there's been a longstanding conversation going back well before the time of the founding, and then especially within the last couple of years, has been maybe kind of revivified. Questions about the compatibility between sort of the broader American political project and the liberal principles underlying it, the compatibility between that and Catholic thought, and maybe more broadly sort of pre-modern political thought, which in many instances are related, if not the same. Mm-hmm. And so this has been a question that, you know, has been formative in my own thinking for some time. And especially in the years before graduate school, between undergrad and grad school, read some things that got me thinking about these questions. And so I think given the prominence of that debate and the concern that many people have in that regard, I find Carroll to be a very fascinating figure because he was, on the one hand, you know, well, a bishop and a priest, a very devout Catholic, you know, I think very orthodox in his faith, but also a very ardent patriot and a very ardent supporter of the American Revolution and in a very particular way of the system of religious tolerance that was established in the United States. So I think he provides a really interesting case study for this kind of broader conversation about whether or not there's compatibility there. And I think he would be on very much on the side of emphasizing that compatibility. Yeah, and so the dissertation will look at some of the formative influences on his thought, both the history in especially the Maryland colony, and then his extensive education. He was a Jesuit up to the time of the suppression in 1773 over in France. And so I had a very robust and long academic life, very familiar with many of the great thinkers. And so he sort of wove these two together in his leadership of Catholics in America. And I think there's some contemporary relevance for this, you know, both in terms of the fundamental principles being discussed in academia, and then also with regards to public life. You know, Catholics are, despite being a relatively small portion of the country, pretty well represented, especially in national politics. So I think from both of those angles, there's a lot of relevance.
It's really interesting. And what's his, I apologize if you already said this, but what's his relationship to Charles Carroll?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Charles Carroll, who is another very prominent Catholic figure in the American Revolution, was his cousin. So Charles was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, in fact, the only Catholic to do so. And his other cousin, Daniel, was at the Constitutional Convention. So the Carroll family was the most wealthy and prominent, certainly Catholic family in the colonies, and one of simply the wealthiest and most influential at all among any group or denomination. And so, especially in the Maryland colony, they had a lot of sway and put that sway in the use of the revolution. So yeah, Charles and Daniel were cousins of his.
Yeah, that's such an important piece to remember. I mean, as an Anglican, as a Protestant, I think there's quite a few of us at the founding, quite an important piece of that. But I also think, this is something to lament, the way that Catholics are eventually treated over the course of American history. You know, there's certainly discrimination against them at the time, but it seems to have picked up later in the 19th century in particular, as you especially get kind of related to immigration as Catholics from overseas come in more. And also then, of course, at the time of JFK, you know, there's some of the conspiratorial thinking, like he's just going to be a puppet of the Pope, which is ridiculous. But there's so many interesting conversations we could have there. I had a but it's encouraging. What's there's an author I'm trying to think of. Is it Breidenbach, the guy who writes the book on some of the Catholic influences on? Yeah, I have
very
not
important
read
to give
yet.
Him a shout out. His book was influential in the development of this idea. Yeah,
I was just thinking, I had not thought of that before we started the show. But yeah, that's stuff. I'll have to put that in the show notes if I remember. But his book looked really interesting. I bought it. I haven't read it.
I'd highly recommend it. Yeah, very well done.
Excellent, excellent. So, and we're focusing on religious liberty. I was curious, Charles Carroll, I know he's written some things, but in terms of like the actual process of researching this guy, John Carroll, how are you going about it? Does he have, I'm guessing there's not some collected works. Are you looking at his sermons? Are there specific archives you hope to get to?
Yeah, so I've been very fortunate. I actually do have right in front of me here on my desk his collected works.
Oh, there are. Okay, great.
Yeah, so this was done, I think, in the mid-20th century. So pretty extensive and thorough. And this includes, many sermons, also quite a few private letters. And then he has a number of sort of public writings, a few directly on political matters, one or two that he wrote anonymously. And so it's a pretty extensive covering. And then there's an additional book that was done a couple of years ago, sort of recovering some more minor abstracts and things along those lines. So fortunately, a lot of the archival work has been done for me. So there's a little bit of that, but I've been pretty fortunate, and especially in the modern age of technology, for all the problems that it might cause for us socially, it's been very handy for the purposes of research, having a lot of that accessible instantaneously.
I always had mixed feelings about that. When I did my dissertation on Thoreau, I could get every letter, notebook, and everything I could possibly need online. But I really wanted an excuse to go spend some time. I mean, I've been to Walden Pond, but the Thoreau Institute whatever it's called, Walden Woods, there's a library up there that I would love to have spent more time at. The archival research, that notion, it's kind of this mixed blessing. On the one hand, we can research extensively from a distance, but it also, there is something to be said about going to the place, especially if the place is connected to the thinker that we're writing about. So, because I know his in John Carroll's case, the church where he started at, is it still there in Maryland?
Yes, it was the church that he began the process of building and oversaw the design and everything. I think it was completed after his lifetime.
Oh, really?
In Baltimore. So there's a basilica there. Very, very beautiful. And actually a very interesting topic in the way that he adopted, sort of American architectural principles. And he has some things to say about this. The way in which he wanted that building to manifest the American sort of character of American Catholicism. And so it was very intentional in the design of the building to, make it familiar sort of to American architectural principles and expressive of that desire to be, cooperative full members of the American project. And I'll also mention, in terms of beautiful places, John Carroll was the founder of Georgetown University. Well known, obviously. It's a beautiful, beautiful campus. So I've yet to go there for any archival purposes. But yeah, if there's an opportunity, I certainly wouldn't mind. It's such a beautiful place.
That's great. And there's also, John Carroll University in Ohio.
That's right.
What's the relate? I mean, did they just really liked him and named it after him, or did he have some connection to Ohio? Do we know?
You know, I'm not super familiar. The school was founded, you know, much later,
right?
And he was in Baltimore for his entire life, or his entire episcopacy after he returned from France. So he didn't spend any significant amount of time. I don't know if he ever made it that far. I'm not sure, but they do take him as their namesake.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, there's so much work to be done, and I think it's also important to. It's so much of the overlap between the Catholic and Protestant traditions, especially when it came to civil society, natural law, civic virtue, all these things, as well as republicanism as a political philosophy, which I think is a. I remember reading, and this is just coming to mind now. There was some. This kind of this tension between republicanism and liberalism and where Catholics fit in it. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but is there a sense in which, how do Protestants and Catholics relate to republicanism and liberalism in the Lockean sense? How do they relate to them differently, if at all? And I think that's an interesting part of this piece, which I did not prepare to talk about early this morning, but. That's a different conversation. I want to move on now to, so you were at the conference last week. So this is March 19th, 2025. We were in Harrisonburg, Virginia together with 150 of our friends at a sold out event, which was so refreshing and encouraging. I'm just wondering, so you've been there at least twice to our conference. What's your take on the conference? What has been your experience so far?
I was not paid to say this, but it really is my favorite academic conference that I've been to. Yeah, which is why I've been, thankfully, twice now. Should have been intended to go last year, but had conflicts with mandatory stuff going on here for grad school. But yeah, I hope to go many more times. Yeah, so I enjoyed the Ciceronian Society conference very, very much. I think the reasons for that are perhaps fundamentally the sort of enthusiasm and excitement that's present there. And so I think that comes across in terms of the research and the presentations. You really get the very strong feeling that people are deeply engaged in what they're thinking about and writing about and presenting, and they do it with a lot of passion and enthusiasm. And in my experience, that's maybe not always present, especially in political science conferences, sometimes a little bit more dry, and occasionally you get the sense that maybe a presentation was written on the plane ride over a little hastily, but I certainly never get that impression at Ciceronian Society. And so I think the presentations are very well done, very insightful, and offer a lot to think about. And then the sort of communal aspect outside of the presentations is also simply phenomenal. I think people who are coming together in search of a particular kind of community, really find it there and are very excited about that. So the entire week of, conversations afterwards and meals together and prayer together and all those sorts of things is remarkably rich.
Excellent. Well, I'm really glad to hear that. Check is in the mail. Just kidding. yeah, I think there's, well, I, you know, I should give the caveat that not everyone prepared that well. I got put on a panel kind of a couple of weeks before the conference, and I definitely wrote that paper that morning. Wasn't much of a paper. It was more of a roundtable discussion. So I did not lead by example this time. So anyone who is in that panel and you're listening, I'm sorry, but I warned y'all in that room. There was a panel on kind of the engaging the conversation of comparing ancient Rome, especially the ancient Roman Republic in America, which is always a fun topic. Fraught with peril, but also lots of good conversation. Now, this is, and we talked about this beforehand, this is called the Nisbet Fellowship, which I think really works well. And you had mentioned the way that this kind of ties things together in both in terms of your research and Ciceronian Society. I wonder if you could elaborate on that again.
Yeah, so it's really an honor to have received this fellowship and be a part of this program, because Nisbet was very formative in my own thinking. Going back a few years ago, first came across his book around 2020. So right before I came to graduate school and when I was, considering where to go. And so I think that, one of his insights in his book, The Quest for Community, is that we've lost many of these intermediary institutions in social life that are necessary for human flourishing. And that in lieu of these, the state very often comes in to fill those gaps. And so I think that with regards to the project that I presented at the conference on Smith and Montesquieu and their observations on the relationship between commerce and religion, sort of the connection of that to civil society. Yeah, I think Nisbet is connected very much to that, and also to John Carroll in a certain way. He identifies the church as one of those preeminent sort of intermediary institutions that's necessary for people to have that experience of rootedness and community in which authentic friendship and human flourishing take place. Yeah, and so I think with respect to the effects of, modern commercialism, and we can get more into this a little bit, but just to put it briefly, I think there are certain features of what the growth in that sort of prosperity and that sort of way of life will have on the spirit of the people, the sort of overall character of the nation, and then in particular its religious component. And as I draw out of the paper, some of those predictions or observations that they make have to do with a sort of diminishment of some of the traditional elements, maybe of medieval Christianity, and a real emphasis on sort of independence, not necessarily atomization, but there's potentially some sort of nexus there.
Right. And there's, that distinction between independence and atomization or individualism, right? That whole notion. A lot of times these words are thrown around without necessarily defining them as carefully, which we can come back to. But I want to, let's turn to the paper now. I think this is a good example of a paper at the Ciceronian Society where you're saying, look, I'm making these observations, I got these examples, let's put them forward, see what you think. And and this is just for those listening, when you're thinking about an academic conference, yes, is it great when you present a fully formed, complete idea, if that is even a thing? But it's also, I think, helpful when you say, look, I trust you as this community I'm a part of, to be honest with me. Like, is this a good idea, a bad idea? Is this a train wreck of a paper, or is this a promising thing? And I was not in the room when you presented. Unfortunately, I missed a lot of the presentations. But I think this is a great paper, and I think it's a good example of what we're looking for. And I think it's an opportunity to discuss a lot of things. We won't be able to cover all this here in this podcast. But you're looking at observations specifically between Adam Smith and Montesquieu. We don't need to, for our audience, I don't think we need to review who those two individuals were. If you don't know who they were, please Google it immediately. Otherwise, this might not make sense going forward. And you make 4 points about kind of this interplay between what you're calling commercialism and religion. But before I move on, when you say commercialism, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think there's this sort of broader emphasis on commerce as a way of life. So primary focus on the development of industry and manufacture and science for the purpose of greater production and trade, but ultimately for the purpose of, increasing human prosperity and the alleviation of man's estate. And then in a more particular way that has a sort of conjunction in the political sphere with an orientation of society towards those goods as some of the preeminent goods to be sought after. And so there's a sort of commercial republicanism that's talked about, in this era, a move towards this kind of framework. And, we see this in the American experiment, for example, certainly in the 19th century, massive explosion, commerce, industry, trade, all the sort of subsidiary elements of commerce that really, kind of radically lead to a great growth and prosperity for the country and sort of a shift in the character of the people. Yeah, the orientation of society.
It may help just for the purposes of kind of making distinctions here. If we weren't a commercial republic, what's the alternative, essentially? I mean, I think there's, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think there is, you're right, in this orientation. It also sounds very Protestant, right? Like kind of the Protestant work ethic and almost a Lockean sense of industry. But what makes a, like if we weren't a commercial republic, what would we be? So surely before America, you have, you know, societies that require some level of commerce, right, in industry. And but what makes a commercial republic different than say, you know, what went before, right? The Roman Republic, for example. Would we call the Roman Republic commercial or commercialistic? Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that historical component is important because there aren't very many alternatives, certainly amongst developed countries. You know, that's also in a certain way synonymous, that a modern developed country would be sort of commercial in this sense. So I think, for an example of that kind of thing, you'd have to look about to this era shortly beforehand in which Smith and Montesquieu were writing, where there was this kind of transition from older forms. So I think maybe the fundamental orientation of a sort of commercial republic is towards greater and greater growth in these precursor elements, industry and other things like that, that lead to a greater capacity for trade and the building of wealth. Whereas prior forms of commercialism, you know, obviously trade and, you know, any kind of economic exchange certainly goes back much, much further than this era, you know, straight through human history. Yeah, it seems to me that the emphasis on the sort of perpetual growth and advancement, and again, that advancement tied with the advancements in science, and the relationship of that to industry, seemed to be a very important distinguishing factor that people like Smith and Montesquieu pick up on very clearly.
Well, I think, too, one way we could also compare it is to, let's say, a more mercantilist or... although there's certainly aspects of commercialism and mercantilism in there, but also serfdom, right? I mean, there is. I don't think you would consider Russia at this particular point in history, in the late 18th, early 19th century, as a commercial republic. Essentially, it's much more. It's agrarian, but it's also, you know, the serfdom-ish character of it is not commercial in any sense. Yeah, I think there's also a sense in which now, with, you know, freer markets, more people participating in that industry, in that, and also in the benefits of it, I should say, right? I mean, that's part of what's going on here. Is that now, it's not just colonial type, a colonial economy where so much of the fruits of the labor go toward the metropole, toward the colonial center, and so now, you know, America is going to be distinguished at this point by not only that we're all involved in labor and production, but that we also benefit from it. Right. Is that kind of what you're going for?
Yeah. I think it's very well put.
So the first thing you say here, you say first, I'm going to just read straight from your paper. First, commercialism and independence go together such that where commercialism increases, so too will an independent spirit increase in religion specifically. And this has the effect of cultivating the habits of a free people. So thus, in turn, a people habituated to independence in their religion, so you kind of flip it there, independence in their religion will be more suited to a commercial enterprise and political independence. So this is interesting. So why do you make that connection? Because I would think, in some ways, why do they have to be connected? If religion is not really a commercial enterprise, right? It is kind of counterintuitive, right? And then the independence of a commercial, commercial independence. How do you connect them?
Sure. Yeah, and I think this is one of those areas where what are distinct disciplines in an academic sense converge in real social dynamics. So this is one of the elements that I think Montesquieu is particularly helpful on, the characterization and description of different peoples. And, you know, he ties this to any of number of things, including geography and climate and elements like that. And these all sort of interplay with each other. And so he says at one point that Protestantism in particular is more readily adopted in certain areas amongst those who have a spirit of independence and liberty. And so the fundamental character type, which is formed by many of these different elements, commerce being one of them, but a very prominent one, leads to a sort of inclination or, you know, predisposition for religious forms, which are more amenable to that character type, if that makes sense. And so commerce has a particular way of furthering those sort of innate characteristics, and in many situations, potentially even bringing them forth where other elements, you know, like geography or climate alone might not. And so there's that particular place and a few others where Montesquieu makes these sort of comments that the character of independence and liberty leads to a preference for certain religious forms. He especially emphasizes Protestantism of a particular kind. And so I don't think that he explicitly, you know, in one line makes that connection between commerce and religion. But I think that crux of the
right. And
independence,
I think there's,
and liberty that it creates.
Yeah, and this gets to an argument I think that a lot of people, you know, and there's also this piece of correlation and causation. Does one influence the other? And I think there'd be, you know, there's all these other variables to put in place there. But there's also this notion of free markets being a space and opportunity for, within which, so, you know, that independence can be not simply obtained. And when we say independence, you know, we're not meaning complete autonomy. I think there's a way in which commercialism, how do I say this, provokes the need for religious self-governing principles, right? This is kind of the John Adams idea that this constitution is made for, this constitution is made for a holy religious people, or it needs to be that we need a religious people for this to work. I think the same is true for a commercial republic, in the sense that simply saying free market, we're good to go, but there's also this element of like, look, this will only work if we are guided by virtue and faith for different reasons. But at the same time, would Smith and Montesquieu agree with what I just said, that you would need that aspect?
I think they're very emphatic about this. This is addressed to some extent in the paper. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that need for morality in a free society for the sake of ordered liberty. They connect that very clearly with religion as the preeminent means of cultivating and instilling that sort of morality and virtue in a people. And so, to be clear, while they, you know, have these observations and predictions about maybe the shifting character of religion, they certainly don't anticipate or desire, you know, its total removal. They see it as very, very important for these things.
Right. I remember that being, I've read the requisite Montesquieu to have passed my comprehensive exams, and the same thing with Adam Smith. But, you know, I remember diving more deeply into theory of moral sentiments. I think there's some problems there. I think there's some limitations as to what he can offer, but he's certainly admirable in this sense. I mean, he doesn't see it as just simply mathematical. You just put all these pieces together I think that sometimes that's the way some kind of economic arguments are presented, as if, well, if you just do the math right and you get the free market right and you put it and you follow the formula, essentially, you know, we'll just spontaneously be able to be moral. But that's not the case. You need to develop a sense of what a full human person is, and religion provides that ground for that. That's a much longer conversation that we could talk about for years. Now, your second point says commercialism fosters religious pluralism, which is interesting, which softens conflicts. This is counterintuitive as well, I think. Pluralism particularly diminishes religious enthusiasm and superstition, which threatens civic peace, whereas religious oppression breeds intolerance and strife. Religious pluralism will pacify sectarian fervor. Yeah, so what do you mean by that?
When you have different communities, different nations that are engaged with each other in trade and in commerce, not only are they, you know, interacting simply in terms of the exchange of goods, but in that context, there's, you know, human connection and discussion of different ways of life, different religious doctrines and affiliations. And so these things come to be spread more easily the greater contact there is between different communities. And so, you know, it rings the bell for me, even going all the way back to Socrates down at the Piraeus, you know, and these new gods entering the city, the beginning of the Republic leading to all sorts of new examinations. But so it's a function of the sort of opening of these avenues of exchange that include cultural exchange that bring these ideas in front of people in a way that they cannot be compared. And then more than that, there's a need for cooperation in trade between countries writ large and between individuals. And so, whereas more isolated, culturally isolated communities might be wary of outsiders and, you know, intolerant of ideas that are inconsistent with their own mores and customs or religious beliefs, those can be set aside far more easily in that context.
Well, I think there's also, if we conceive of free markets as a space in which, or the marketplace essentially as ideally a place in which relationships are developed, in which this commercialism can take place, then there is a, how do I say this, a humanization between the two participants in any transaction. Ideally, I mean, hopefully. I think one of the things that would challenge, you know, that Montesquieu and Smith could not possibly have anticipated was kind of this depersonalization of market interactions, right? Where I have no idea who I'm buying from. It's online, right? And so there's a breakdown in some of this. Although I think there's still a pluralist aspect, right? Seldom have I ever thought to myself, well, am I buying this thing on Amazon from someone of another religion? If I was, I don't really care. You know, there, like, is this a good product? Did you do a good job? Are you charging a fair price? You know, there's an element in which commercialism helps foster relationships in spite of pluralism, right? Where it's this kind of unifying factor, like, hey, we all got to work together to prosper here, and we may not worship the same God, but we do have the same material needs. We still want, we both want peace, right? I think that's interesting. That's something that I think could be developed more as to where those two pieces fit. Yeah, because I mean, you know, there's something to be said about this kind of sectarian fervor and division develops too much, it's going to hurt your trade. Now, it doesn't mean we abandon or soften what we believe. But we say, look, we got to work together. We share this planet. We share this marketplace. We share common needs. We have to work together. And so I think you're onto something there, that the commercialism moves us in a direction of toleration. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Yeah, just to pick up on a comment that you made, you know, shouldn't be exaggerated the degree to which this would completely ameliorate all conflicts. You know, you think of like Friedman's golden arches theory, you know, right, which we found out is not in fact true. So there are limits on it. But yeah, within a community, it does have a tendency to diminish that conflict.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely one that ends up being not true. Your third point, and this is very small R Republican of you, that your third, luxury reduces moral austerity and cultivates a popular morality amenable to liberal freedom. Luxury further softens religious enthusiasm and lowers men's sights to the affairs of this world rather than those of the next. Vain superstitions give way to clear thinking about the means to alleviate man's estate. Now, I'm not sure how I feel about this point, to be honest with you. Reduces moral austerity and cultivates a popular morality amenable to liberal freedom. I don't think of luxury necessarily as a good thing all the time, right? I think in that it can have this corrupting influence. And maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but are you saying it, or at least Montesquieu and Smith maybe saying it a little differently, that luxury may actually have a positive influence in spite of what people like Cato and others would have said in the ancient Roman Republic, right? Where luxury seems to undermine Republican virtue. Are Montesquieu and Smith saying something different?
No, I think it's similar. I think their primary emphasis here is on the sort of moderating effect. And so what they're coming after, what they dislike and they hope commerce will sort of drive away is excess in sort of religious fervor and enthusiasm. And so with respect to austerity, one of the elements that they see this leading to is a sort of resignation from any concern for man's material well-being. And so in the case of overly contemplative religious doctrines or ways of life that sort of abnegate any responsibility or emphasis on the affairs of this world and finding virtue and value in those kind of enterprises leads men to set those kind of things aside, which is harmful to the well-being of society. And so they're certainly not advocating the further extreme, total libertinism and luxury to the extent that it completely corrupts any sort of moral virtue and the capacity for self-government. But they want it to sort of strike in the middle, if that makes sense.
Maybe. I wonder, again, I may be misunderstanding, but is there a sense in which they're saying, and again, I don't, they would not have used this word, but that this commercialism, luxury, and this prosperity, does it moderate a tendency toward what might be better called ideology, a sense of this kind of, over the top loyalty to or adherence to certain abstract ideas and ideals at the expense of peace and the dignity of the human person. I mean, is that kind of what they're getting at? Like, they're not, again, they don't think they have the word ideology yet, right? Marx
Yeah,
isn't,
that's exactly right. I
is
think the
it.
word that they use in lieu of ideology is enthusiasm, which, for us
Okay.
today is usually has a very positive connotation and is something that
Right.
we like. I think I may have used that word early
Yeah.
on in a positive way. But the way in which they use it is exactly like you're describing. And it's a very negative connotation. They see it as excessive and, potentially inauthentic to true religion, but certainly counterproductive for social peace and prosperity. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the points to make here, and this is actually in some ways made me think of Machiavelli, actually. Machiavelli says something to the effect of, I'm not quoting him here, but he says, how much can people tolerate from you taking things away? Once you take away, their property in particular, he said, then they become more unstable, more dangerous. And I remember the takeaway from whatever that passage in Machiavelli that's randomly coming to my mind now. Is that some of the most dangerous people, the people that you cannot control anymore from the prince's perspective in Machiavelli, are the people who have nothing to lose, right? And that's kind of where ideology can also set in. I mean, there's something in which luxury may pacify us in the bad sense, where we become more compliant, maybe when we shouldn't be, right? I mean, there's something in which said about which, well, we don't want to lose anything, so we're just going to roll over and not resist. But there's also the sense in which if we have less, we're in desperation sets in. We might be more given to kind of radical responses to that. Might be less obedient when we should be. Is that kind of what they're getting at? Or am I
Yeah, I
getting that
think
wrong?
that's certainly right. Yeah, and I think, there's nothing as potent for a revolution like a hungry mob or something like that with people
Right.
who, yeah, are really on the knife's edge. Yeah, so I think to some degree, that's what they see in, the limits on or the effect maybe of these more enthusiastic or extreme tendencies that would be harmful to prosperity. And so yeah, unlike the people who are either disengaged from concerns of this life on account of what they would deem a sort of exaggerated emphasis merely on concerns of the other life, the next life, or people who are disengaged, yeah, because of poverty, this would have the effect of ameliorating both of those tendencies by, increasing the prosperity of the people, giving them more of a stake in their own livelihood, and then also, yeah, diminishing this sort of exaggerated otherworldliness.
It really, yeah. I mean, there's again. This is a personal. I don't want to go on a rant because this podcast is not about me. But it also sounds a little bit like the, I mean, I see what you're saying, that moderating impact, right? That don't get to a point where you're so, you know, where this world doesn't matter, right? I mean, where it's just, well, you know, I know as I've heard some, I grew up in the evangelical world and it's like, well, the rapture is going to happen any minute now. So why care about this planet or this world? Well, that doesn't strike me as a Christian attitude. But also, like, if you're so desperate, right, where you're genuinely poor, you're just trying to survive. You're also not, you know, you're focused so on, you know, so much on just surviving that there's also going to be things that are missed as well. But I think there's this tendency, this goes throughout the 19th century and beyond, where there's this critique of Christianity in particular, where it says that we as Christians are so otherworldly that we don't care about the poor or the world itself, which I think is overstated and false in most instances. But it is an interesting dynamic. And I think part of that is, and this goes way beyond what you're writing about, but I think this dichotomy between the spiritual life and the other world, I don't even want to say the next world, because that kind of perpetuates the problem. This belief that the natural and the supernatural constantly have to be separated. I think there's, you know, there's room to come back and say, look, yes, some Christians can get so otherworldly, for lack of a better word, that they neglect our responsibilities here, but there's this other sense in which, look, I really want a bunch of monks and nuns praying for us on a regular basis, because I don't think that is so, I think that's essential. Like, I can't imagine us not doing that. I don't think there's this false divide between kind of spiritual health and material health and all that, because it kind of gets at this notion that ends up in the, you know, comes back in the late 18th and early 19th century of kind of a non-incarnational Christianity, right? We have to have, where it's essentially kind of separating the material and the immaterial world. But again, that's a longer rant. You don't have to respond to that. But so your fourth point, we'll have to finish here. Let's see if we can do this quickly. I doubt it. So you say ecclesiastical participation in modern commerce decreases the church's largesse and reduces the dependence of the people on the church. Ecclesiastics retain less wealth as they participate in commercial consumption, while the people are better able to shift for themselves, and need less of the church's generosity. That's an interesting point. Is that a double-edged sword? The increased wealth of the people further negates the sway which opponent worship has on their minds. I guess. Well, what are you trying to say there? I mean, is there something in which the church has less power, has less need of becoming overly wealthy? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. So there's a line here in Montesquieu where he says the very poverty of peoples is a motive attaching them to that religion, which has served as a pretext for those who have caused their poverty. Mm. So especially going back, you know, sort of briefly mentioned, maybe an older feudal system in which the church, you know, especially the Catholic Church is one that concerns them a good deal, you know, has amassed greater wealth and a more close economic connection with the people. There's a sort of dependency there. Mm-hmm. And so this is undone in two regards. The first I find very interesting, and he doesn't really elaborate at any great length on examples of this, something that he discusses, that, yeah, the sort of amassed wealth can be spent in commerce on luxuries and things that maybe are not as fundamental or essential. And so there's a sort of dissipation of the sort of amassed wealth in the first place. But then also because the people who are enjoying greater prosperity and participation in this commercial system more and more have the means to supply their own needs, in which case there's less dependence on some supervening structure, you know, which contemporary circumstances is more often the state, but historically very often would have been the church in that regard. And then I'm not sure if that was a typo there in the paper, but the second section there, opulent worship, the effect that has on
which opulent worship.
Yeah, sorry about that. Opponent worship. But Yeah, so there's some insights there, and I think they're certainly not the exact same point, but they're related in that poor rural peasants are going to be very awed by the sort of opulence of especially Catholic, kind of medieval worship, so distinct from their own experience, sort of poverty and simplicity. And given the sort of psychological effect this has, that leads to a sort of psychological and spiritual, dependency and submission to that authority, which again, the more and more people are raised out of poverty, the less and less there's that sort of divide between their own experience and what they're seeing in these forms of religious worship, such that those forms have less sway over their minds.
That's interesting. I've never thought of that in my life because growing up middle class, you don't go into a very wealthy church necessarily and think about kind of, the worship of the, so it's the worship of the wealth. Essentially, the idea is that the, I'm going to try and say the same thing in a different way, that Mo, where Mo, was Montesquieu essentially, or Smith, they were worried about some folks who were going to the church simply for its wealth. Is that what they're basically saying?
Yeah, that's right. Both in terms of sort of material dependence and then also the sort of majesty of the worship having a psychological effect.
Well, I think the majesty of the worship can be, important as well. I mean, how do we, this is very Aristotelian of us, right? Where's the balance between, too much and too little? Where is, I mean, growing up Protestant, I think there is something lost in this dramatic austerity of Protestant churches where there's no art. There's just, pews, a podium and a cross, right? Where no one's going in there because of this, you're not overawed by the opulence. But at the same time, there is something to be said about when you go into a church that clearly has, given a lot of time and money to worship in the sense of its physical structure. I mean, thinking of the church, the Sacré Cœur in Paris, which I went to years ago, the beauty of that place brought me to tears. And I think there's something to that. It wasn't because it was wealthy. It was because this points me to an awesome, beautiful God, right? And I think, I think trying to draw those distinctions is important here. Yeah, I've never thought of it that way. I have thought of, when I've gone into a church where the way they've spent their money makes me angry. Do you know how many fog machines do you need? Right, there's just a there's an absurdity to it, where that just doesn't seem to reflect that. I mean, we could go on about that for a long time, but well,
And I might just add, briefly, if I may, I find it interesting, some of these comments or observations they make about certain religious forms, at times hit a little too close to home. They talk about this sort of dislike for monastic otherworldliness. Reading that, I couldn't help but remember the one time I spent a whole month in contemplative silence on a retreat. And I don't think they would have really loved that. So, and similarly, with this last section we're talking about, I think there are, maybe areas where even I and Smith and Montesquieu might disagree, but I think their observations are nonetheless, poignant and accurate to some degree.
And this is such the story of a lot of political thought and theology in many ways for the last, especially the last, I'd say 200, 300 years, where you see a legitimate issue, right? And you completely overreact, or you just take the, there's, and this is certainly true today. It's more true today than maybe any time in history, where you see a genuine problem and you overcorrect. I mean, especially in the world of social media, which just hates nuance, where you want to simplify a problem and you want a simple solution, but the truth is it's much more complicated, right? And this is an example, perhaps, where Montesquieu and Smith overdo that, especially with the kind of this suspicion of the contemplative life, which now we desperately need it, right? Like you said, a month in silence. I mean, I don't know if I could be quiet myself for a month, but I mean, just to have that much silence would be a great joy, a great Sabbath, right? Because there's that aspect of a commercial republic in which we lose that notion of Sabbathing. In fact, actually, This is a random fact. You can dig into this if you want. I don't have the receipts in front of me, but I think, you know, and prior to this rise of commercialism, there is a culture in both in Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox traditions around the world, but especially in the West, where fasting was far more, and Sabbathing were both far more common, right? As a regular practice that was, I mean, Sabbathing continues, but fasting in particular. And then the research has shown that that practice of fasting, especially among Protestants, and I would argue Catholics, diminishes dramatically with the rise of this commercial culture. What is that? You know, again, you don't have to answer this because this was not part of the paper, but in a sense, there is this decline in that. Back in the Middle Ages, there were actually laws in some cases where against it, like people were fasting too much. But the rise of the commercial republic, does it work against some of these fasting practices, which are so crucial to a contemplative life, to spiritual health, and to prayer?
Yeah, I think that is a very broad conversation, which I'll certainly exceed our time in trying to answer. So I'll just briefly plug author that I'm sure many members of the Ciceronian Society are familiar with, Joseph Pieper, who has a great deal to say on these topics. And I think truly insightful.
That'd be great, man. Well, Theodore, thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. At the time of this recording, once again, March 19th, 2025, we're still working on confirming a date and location for our 2026 conference, but we hope to have that worked out very soon. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.